Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Here's one response to the invasion of Ukraine built around the idea that the pen is mighty, not just the sword. It's an international gathering of writers in Greenwich Village, plus another group in Los Angeles, beginning today. It's being organized by the free speech writers group known as PEN. They're calling it an Emergency World Voices Congress in response to the invasion. It's part of their annual PEN World Voices Festival happening today through Saturday here in New York and in L.A. A main feature of this convening will be their annual Arthur Miller Freedom to Write Lecture, to be given this year by probably the best-known Ukrainian novelist and president of PEN Ukraine, Andrei Kirkov. His novel Grey Bees, set in eastern Ukraine after the Russian invasion of Crimea, is now out in paperback in this country in English, translated from the original Russian. Andrei Kirkov joins us now, along with PEN America CEO Suzanne Nossel. Suzanne, welcome back. And Andrei Kirkov, thanks for coming on the show. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Brian.
Suzanne, would you set the festival scene for us first? You're making a point, I see, of concentrating a whole bunch of events in one New York neighborhood, Greenwich Village. A few writers have walked those streets over the years, Greenwich Village. Is it usually more spread out, though?
It has been more spread out in the past. We've always wanted to give people the experience of a true festival where you can sort of walk from event to event, and it's a whole immersive experience on a beautiful spring weekend. And so we're hoping that there's more of that feeling. It's very easy to take in two or three events in succession, particularly over the weekend. So we're inviting New Yorkers to do that. And I think we're all hungry for some inspiration, for some enlightenment, some voices from outside of our bubble. And that's really what the festival provides.
Did you even have a PEN World Voices Festival in person the last 2 years with the pandemic?
We did not. In 2020, it was very sad because the festival was entirely planned and ready to go in March. And of course, we had to cancel the entire thing. We went virtual, but it was a far cry from the experience of sort of these vibrant events and parties and people getting together, not having seen each other. And then last year, it was almost entirely virtual because the pandemic was really still raging. And so it's a big deal to be back in person. I think New Yorkers are hungry for this kind of engagement and the chance to meet writers face to face. It's actually remarkable. We've had one writer who has had to pull out due to COVID. But, other than that, many dozens who are already here in the U.S. ready to go. And so we are very excited about what's about to unfold over the next 5 days.
Many dozens of writers with many dozens of laptops and iPads, no doubt. Andrei, I see a theme of the conference is the role of the writer in times of turmoil and brutality. Do you feel like you have a role in the current war as a Ukrainian writer, or have the bombs and missiles and the physical bravery of the national defense overwhelmed whatever role writers might have?
Well, any Ukrainian writer has a role, and actually they are playing different roles in this situation in Ukraine. I have been just reading actually messages from the front line where Ukrainian writer and member of PEN Ukraine, Artem Chekh, is sitting in the trenches actually and fighting the enemy who is trying to occupy the whole of Ukraine. Majority of writers actually are writing essays and texts about what is happening now in Ukraine. Personally, I stopped writing my novel that I was writing before the war, and I'm doing the same actually. I'm giving talks and lectures about situation in Ukraine. I'm publishing several texts in different mass media over the world every week. I'm in touch with writers who are now actually in hiding in occupied territories, in the town of Melitopol or in occupied Kherson. So I mean, the activists and the administration of Ukrainian PEN Center is keeping in touch with every member, and we are also collecting money to send money to those who are either as refugees abroad or even on occupied territories or as IDPs, internally displaced persons, in the western part of Ukraine. So most of the writers became either activists or, I mean, they were activists, but I mean, they were became much more active, and they are trying to help the country and to help the other writers.
Can you tell us a little bit about your novel, Gray Bees? First, what does the title refer to?
Well, actually, this is a novel about gray zone. Gray zone exists in every war, especially if the war is frozen. And one can say that Ukrainian-Russian war in Donbas was frozen from 2014-2015. And gray zone is a strip of land which has the same length as the front line, because this is the space between positions of the Russian and separatist army and positions of Ukrainian army. And this gray zone is sometimes 300 meters wide, sometimes several miles wide. And there were dozens of villages and even a part of the town of Avdiivka that found themselves in this no man's land. These villages were and are without electricity, without gas, without running water, without post offices and pharmacies and any kind of medical help. And there were thousands of people who remained there in the middle of the war. So this actually novel I wrote to give voice to these people, because when I started writing this novel, there were already 200 books published about the war in Donbas, and they were all about battles, about combat, about Ukrainian soldiers and separatists, etc. But there was not much attention paid to the civilians that were caught up with the war. So this is a story about two enemies from the childhood, the only two inhabitants of the village who remained in the village after everyone else left because of the war. And the main character, Sergeyich, is the beekeeper. So in the beginning, he defends in this war only his bees, because he doesn't understand the reason for the war. And at some point, he decides to take his bees away from the war for holidays to the Ukrainian-controlled territory to give them a chance to collect pollen on the fields not destroyed by the war and not covered with burned gunpowder. So, I mean, it's this human story of somebody who is trying to understand what is happening, who is a bee, like a human bee, because actually he loves his bees, because he is also was a hard-working miner who didn't care about his salary or about what country he lives in, because he was only working and surviving. And this is a war about also annexation of Crimea, because this is the first case when the life in the annexed Crimea is described. This is the third part of the novel. And for this, I am very grateful to Crimean Tatars, who were my advisors and told me everything what was happening there. And I could actually also describe Crimean Tatar life before and after annexation.
You know, I've read, and I haven't read the book, I've only read about the book, but one thing I read is that a theme is about Ukrainians after the Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014, maybe like your beekeeper, trying to live normal private lives, but politics and war keep getting in the way. Would you put it that way yourself?
Well, this is part of the topic, but in fact, actually, the main character slowly understands what is happening, because naturally he is good. He knows what is good and what is bad, what is truth and what is lie. And the situations he finds himself in actually make him not a better person, but better understanding person, more politically engaged, more reflective. So this is actually also about growing in one's head as a citizen, from being actually just an inhabitant to the level of being a citizen of the country.
Suzanne, that could be such a universal thought, right? In this country and so many places that maybe aren't even in the midst of the acute crisis that Ukraine is in right now, where people who are just trying to live their ordinary lives do a disservice if they don't get involved, and then something makes them.
No, I agree. I think it's true in our own country, Brian. I mean, we've been in a series of cascading crises right here, you know, as an organization that works on free expression issues. What we've witnessed over the last several years in terms of the denigration of truth, the rise of disinformation, online harassment, the demise of local news, the polarization, you know, I think really forces all of us to consider our role in this. And that's actually one of the reasons we're hosting the Emergency Writers Congress that you mentioned as part of the festival. We felt, look, we've got all of these writers from all over the world who are grappling with this. And, you know, it's a situation where really government is falling short. If we're relying on government to solve, you know, this chaos, it's clear that governments are divided, they're paralyzed internally. And so the question becomes, you know, who's going to step forward? And, you know, what is the role of civil society? What is the role of authors like Andre, who have an important audience and message and a power in their ability to deliver it? And so we're trying to use this moment in a catalytic way to elevate our collective ability to kind of meet this moment.
What else would you say, Suzanne, about the role of literature? Because the press release for the festival and this Emergency Congress of Writers that indicates an all-star lineup of international and American writers in discussion says it's going to be on climate, borders and migration, autocracy and democracy, history and ancestral lineage, and more. And that list of topics could be for a convening of, you know, historians and scientists and economists, the official experts in those fields. So what's the central contribution of writers of fiction, of literature, to what could sound like a public affairs meeting?
Yeah, look, what I think writers bring uniquely is the ability to imagine, to see different futures, to envision things that our policymakers may exclude from their worldview, to help us see what may be on the far horizon. And how we get there. How do we get past this devastating situation in Ukraine? What might the future look like between Russia and its neighbors? How in this country do we overcome polarization? How do we come to grips with the ramifications of technology? You know, can we invent a world where all of this feels a little more controllable, a little more humane? And it's really sort of stories that awaken the ability to think beyond, you know, what can be the very kind of confining and distressing parameters of our daily news cycle, wrapped up as we all are in the threads of our social media. We need authors to help us see beyond that, to sort of pierce the bubble, to be able to envisage something different, and then ultimately to work toward it.
Listeners, we can take a few phone calls in our remaining time. Maybe any writers are out there and want to call in about the role of literature in wartime, the war in Ukraine, or any other, 212-433-WNYC. Any readers of Andre Kirkov or anyone who wants to ask him a question just based on what you're hearing here, or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. As we talk to Suzanne Nossel, the CEO of PEN America and arguably the leading writer of fiction in Ukraine and from Ukraine, Andre Kirkov, his book Gray Bees, set in eastern Ukraine after the Russian invasion of Crimea, is now out in paperback in this country in English, translated from the original Russian. And he will be giving PEN America's annual Arthur Miller Freedom to Write lecture on Friday. In fact, I'll give you the the ticketing information about that. This is going to be at NYU Skirball Center Friday night at 6:30. You can also buy tickets to live stream it, and we'll have a link where people can get more tickets, get tickets or get more information. That's on our webpage at brianlehrershow.org. Andre, I saw where you told the New York Times that you're concerned that the war is going to make literature in Ukraine more militant, and that while vigilance is certainly important right now, you're kind of concerned that literature that may have been more emotionally, politically complex would become more simplistically militant. Am I reading into that correctly?
Well, some books definitely will be and are already, because from 2014, we practically have two literatures in Ukraine instead of one. Because we had until the beginning of this phase of the war, 400,000 Donbas war veterans. And there were a lot of them who started writing books, not only novels and short stories, but diaries and memoirs and their thoughts and essays. And at some point, a couple of years ago, we had already about 300 books published by these people, by these veterans, and they set up their own publishing houses. And I mean, this literature is interesting, but at the same time, traditional writers were trying also to write about the war without their own military experience, but with a lot of empathy, but a lot of actually, I would say, patriotism and excitement. So this bulk of literature, of course, is of different quality, and some books are very good, but some books and many of these books, actually, they will not remain, but they are the reaction to the war, the reaction to what is happening and what was happening in Ukraine. And Ukrainian literature before 2014 was very poetic, romantic, and was not very much politically engaged, because for Ukrainian writers after 1991, actually, the political novels or novels about social issues were something that would provoke associations with the Soviet past, where all the writers were writing politically correct or ideologically correct pro-Soviet prose. So this is changing now completely. So I hope we will have enough love stories also after this war. But the war will remain very present.
Jean in Brooklyn has what looks like a really interesting question. Jean, you're on WNYC.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. No, I just wondered if Andre knows whether the writings that Ukrainians are doing about the war are reaching Russians in Russia.
Yeah, and you write in Russian, Andre, right?
I write fiction in Russian and nonfiction in Ukrainian, and children's books in both languages. The books written in Ukraine not reach in Russia, including my books, which were not published in Russia since 2008. So actually, Russians prefer to either to remain unaware of what is written in Ukraine, or they are limited by the actually limited access to internet, because they don't have access now to Facebook, to Twitter, to Instagram, to YouTube. It was switched off inside Russia by Russian authorities to keep actually Russian society away from the reality of the world.
That's unfortunate. So even your books are being blocked basically from getting the truth into Russia, even works of literature, works of fiction. And kind of to that point, Suzanne, I see that the press release says the festival is in part to forge connections between writers and intellectuals as a counterweight to hostile standoffs. Crucial discussions will collapse geographical distance and bring together colliding perspectives. So how far can that go? Like, you probably don't bring Russian pro-invasion writers to have a dialogue with Andre. Somehow I don't think so. So in the context of this war, at least, is there some version of something?
Yeah, sure. It's a good question, and it's a delicate issue, you know, as you can imagine. And you know, it has not been the moment for that type of convening. Even dissident Russian writers, many of whom have left the country, you know, are there is an understandable sense, I think, and Andre will speak can speak to this, that Ukrainian writers, for them, it's not the moment for that kind of engagement. That said, the interlocutor with Andre on Friday night after his Arthur Miller lecture, by his own choice, is Gary Steingart, the Russian-American writer who we all know and love. And so that is a form of dialogue. At the Writers' Congress on Friday, we'll also have writers from around the world, including a few Russian-American writers. And so, you know, that is a way, and I think an important way, of keeping some level of dialogue open. And we look toward a moment where more will be possible, and where conflicting perspectives will come together. It's not necessarily people who are in favor of Putin's invasion, but just even giving a Russian perspective at this moment for a country that's under bombardment, that's not necessarily the message that people are ready to hear. And we've had interesting debates within Penn about how to deal with Russian culture right now. Should it be boycotted? Should we separate the actions of the regime from individual writers and artists and allow them to be considered on their own terms? Penn is an organization of writers. And so, by their nature, we don't always agree on everything. And that's been, a really important and kind of complex thing to wrestle with.
Hey, Andre, I'm curious, since you're in New York, how you see free speech in the United States. And I don't mean just if you've been here a few days, how you see it on this trip. But if you have any observations in general, looking in from the outside, there are very heated debates here, as you probably know, from both left and right.
Well, I was asked many times about what I think about freedom of press, freedom of speech in the States and in Western Europe. And I can tell you that actually we have similar freedom of speech and freedom to write in Ukraine. Although, of course, in the wartime, not many people listen to what one wants to say. Regarding the opinions, different opinions about the war in Ukraine in the States, I know that some people think that actually America is guilty because they believe Russian narrative. And Russians are very good at propaganda and at spreading any kind of fake news and false narratives. So, in France, I know that if somebody is pro-Putin, it means he is anti-American. And the same is happening now in Latin America, where Russia is very active, spreading the propaganda that Ukraine is an anti-Semitic country and Ukraine is run by fascists. And of course, Ukraine and Ukrainian writers cannot counteract en masse in this situation, although everybody who is interested even for 2 minutes to go into Google and to find out that in Ukraine, a Jewish Russian speaking a young man was elected as a president with 73% of the vote. This will quash immediately any kind of anti-Semitic accusations of Ukraine. The same can be told about so-called fascist government, because in the parliament of Ukraine there is not a single nationalistic party present. So I enjoy freedom of speech in America, in New York. I don't mind when people don't disagree with me and they say their own opinion, because I respect my opinion, but I respect the opponents if they are not using fake news and false narratives as argument.
Since you mentioned fake news and false narratives, before you go, I know you got to go in a couple of minutes. You write book-length stories. Do you also use Twitter or other social media?
I do use Twitter and Facebook. That's my main media. I'm present on Instagram, but what I write usually on Facebook is copied automatically to my Instagram page.
And what do you do in those short forms?
Well, I'm trying to pass the most important messages or the most important captures of the war, of the situation in Ukraine, because I know people are always in a hurry. They don't have time. But even those who are interested to find out more, they don't have time. So one should be very attentive when choosing what to post, what information to share. And I'm trying to be active every day. It is not easy because actually I'm on the move. I'm going from Ukraine usually by car, living car in the nearest airport in Eastern Europe, flying to one or another country and trying to write articles at the same time, giving talks and share what I think is important on Twitter and on Facebook.
Yeah. And Suzanne, last question in this segment, I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about Elon Musk saying yesterday that he would let Donald Trump back on Twitter once his purchase of that platform is finalized, which could be a few months. But he said one of the reasons not to ban someone like Trump permanently is that doing so in a way feeds the radicalization of people who are drawn by what he says, because it makes him look like more of a victim. I wonder if you have an opinion about that.
Yeah, look, I have some sympathy for that perspective, and I've argued myself before the election in 2020 that Trump should not be removed from the platform, that there was some benefit to American voters being able to hear this unfiltered version of the then president and judge for themselves. And I think there's even some evidence that that may have made a difference. And, you know, I think primarily, though, that a platform like Twitter or Facebook has got to articulate a rationale. And I think Musk is right in the sense that he's focusing on the fact that this is a permanent ban. You know, what is the justification for that? You know, perhaps there is one, you know, incitement to violence. Does that, you know, is that a sort of a permanent strike where your account cannot be restored? So I think it's crucial if he takes over. And, you know, even if he doesn't, this is something Twitter never did, which is really articulate and spell out the rules that they were enforcing. And so this came across as kind of an arbitrary decision. Facebook, their oversight board, made the same comment and said the company's got to come up with an articulable rationale for how it's going to handle a case like this. And I think that relates directly to your point, which is without that, you know, people will just think this is high-handed, it's politically motivated. This is a company of, you know, Silicon Valley left-leaners who just don't like Trump. And that does increase polarization and antagonism, and I think has fueled some of Trump's support. Yeah. And so it's complicated.
Versus the fake news and even the danger that provocation could put people in. So that conversation continues. Listeners, if you want to see Andrei Kurkov give the 2022 Arthur Miller Freedom to Write lecture as part of the Pen America World Voices Festival, it's Friday night at 6:30 at NYU Skirball Center. You can also buy tickets to live stream it from wherever you are. We have a link where people can get tickets and more information. That's on our page at brianlehrershow.org. Andrei and Suzanne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.